Tribune and KCPW heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, how Utah's members of Congress reacted to that phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine and to the launch of an official impeachment inquiry. Plus, state officials significantly alter their plans for the Lake Powell pipeline. And a Utah coal mine is expected to resume production with an eye to overseas markets. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley here in studio. Good morning, Brian.
Yeah, it's nice to be back, Roger.
It's good to have you. It's too infrequent. I'm sorry. Also joining us, we've got news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for being here as well, Robert.
Hey, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Tommy, are you there? Good morning, Tommy. Are you there? Hold on. There you are. Gotcha. Hello?
I am here.
Okay, good morning.
Can you hear me there, or are we having a problem with like Ukraine interfering here?
Right. I think that's what it is. They've jumped in on this. Thanks for being here, Tommy. And we are going to start with you. But listeners, if you have questions or comments about the stories we are covering today, give us a call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. A whistleblower complaint over a phone call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. The White House releases a transcript and an official impeachment inquiry is launched. Thomas Burr, before we turn to the reaction of Utah's members of Congress to all of this, can we just do a quick recap of where this all started and where we've gotten to now in this story? It starts with news reports that there was this official complaint from a whistleblower. Actually, that doesn't seem like the right place to start. Maybe we should do what the president said in this phone call and why it was troubling to this whistleblower to file an official complaint.
Sure, there's a lot to unpack here, so let me try to do it as easy and simplistically as I can. So we're talking about a phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's new president, Zelensky. This was July 25th. And according to this now declassified, it's not really a transcript, it's more of like rough notes of what the conversation that took place. The president, you know, calls up the new Ukrainian president, and he says, you know, things like, you know, hey, congratulations, you won big, that's great. You know, and then he notes things like, we do a lot for Ukraine. We spend a lot of time there. Other people should step up and do more, but, you know, we're doing a lot. And it's not really reciprocal what we do for you, but, you know, we're happy to do it. And then the Ukrainian president says, you know, that's great. Appreciate your help. Also, we'd like to buy some missiles. They're called Javelin, kind of defense missiles against Russia to incursion by any chance. And Trump then says, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. Kind of goes into this conversation about which has been pretty much thoroughly debunked, that it was actually Ukraine that had some interference in the 2016 election and not Russia. They talk a little more and the president suggests, so, you know, you should also be, you know, doing some more investigations. I'll have my man Rudy Giuliani call you. You can work with the Attorney General of the United States. This Biden guy, you know, his son was on a board of an energy company there, and there was some really bad stuff. You should look into that. And the Ukrainian president's pretty much like, yeah, okay. This was concerning enough. There's no explicit quid pro quo in there saying, you know, if you don't do this, you're not going to get our money. But at the same time, Trump had ordered millions of federal dollars that were going to be given to Ukraine as a, you know, foreign aid withheld. Hmm. And after Congress pressures, they finally give the money to Ukraine. And after, you know, the Ukrainian president promises to investigate Biden and his son.
And so there's this whistleblower complaint. The whistleblower writes that the president of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 U.S. election. And he or she goes on to say the president's personal lawyer, Mr. Rudolph Giuliani, is a central figure in this effort, and that Attorney General William Barr appears to be involved as well. Part of the complaint is that senior administration officials tried to, quote unquote, lock down the transcript of this call. That's, again, a revelation from the complaint itself. And we'll get to that part of the story in just a minute. But on the phone call and what was said and the release of this complaint, you gathered reactions from the Utah delegation. Maybe we can begin with the split in reactions from our two senators, Mike Lee and Mitt Romney. How did they each react to this, Tommy?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a Mitt Romney kind of stands alone a little bit in Republicans in the Senate in saying that this is really concerning to him. I talked to him a couple times this week. He tweeted out, Sunday as this news is kind of, coming out. If the president asked or pressured Ukraine's president to investigate his political rival, either directly or through his personal attorney, it would be troubling in the extreme. It's critical for the facts to come out. As more of this kind of developed this week, he said at the Atlantic Festival, my reaction is the same as I had a few days ago. It's deeply troubling. When I spoke to him yesterday, it was troubling to have the leader of our nation ask another nation to investigate his political opponents. And contrast that with Senator Mike Lee, who has not had the same reaction in many ways. He did a Facebook Live conversation where he didn't think the phone call was a problem. And, quote, it certainly doesn't serve as the basis for impeaching or removing him from office. And Mike Lee kind of toes the Republican talking points by saying, there are those who don't like this president who have been trying to have him impeached or removed since the day he took office, and they see this as an opportunity. So Romney is really kind of standing alone in many ways, being the voice of being concerned that he doesn't think this is a good thing for the country or for the president to be doing. And Mike Lee is saying, yeah, I don't think it's a problem.
Why? I mean, it's probably too much to ask, but why the distance between these two senators on this? I mean, they're different people. They have different perspectives on the world, obviously. But, how are they reading this so vastly differently? And that actually might be a question I'm realizing for Robert Gerke, the columnist here. I mean, do you want to weigh in on that, Robert? Why there's such a big amount of daylight between these two?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, the Republicans in Congress have fallen right in line, like they have every time there's been something that has come up. When we saw the Mueller report come out, it was the same thing. It was the Republicans say, oh, there's nothing to see here. And then the Democrats are obviously throwing bombs. Romney came to the Senate as sort of saying he was going to speak his mind about the president. And when he would agree with him, he would agree with him. And when he doesn't, he would say he doesn't. And so I think that's what we're seeing. Romney's never really been in the president's camp, so to speak. And so, and we saw it from some of the other sort of somewhat critical senators, people like Ben Sasse and so these guys are going to be a little bit more independent, I guess, than somebody might like Mike Lee, who is a devout partisan.
Okay. We have a question here from someone who called up and didn't stay on the line, but Chris from St. George called in to say or to ask if this call was recorded. This is the call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. And if it was, why not just release the recording? And Tommy, can you address that?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it actually was recorded. I don't know if that's I've seen some talking heads, former like Obama officials, National Security Council people say they don't normally record these calls. And like I was clarifying, when this quote unquote transcript came out, it's not actually a transcript. It reads kind of like a transcript, but it's really notes that were taken by National Security staff in the Situation Room of this phone call that's taking place. I will note that there was a bit of concern about this, that it's a 30-minute phone call. It went from 9:03 a.m. to 9:33 a.m. But the transcript is what, like one, two, like eight pages, I think, or something like that. It's five pages. And you have to understand there's time for translation that goes back and forth. But there could be part of this we're missing, but I don't believe there are recordings.
We talked about the distance between Senator Romney and Senator Lee in terms of reaction to this whistleblower complaint and revelations about this call. Is Romney on board with the impeachment inquiry that House Democrats have launched, Tommy?
He's punting on that one. He pretty much says, that's up to the House. The House is, doing its thing, and I'm not going to tell Nancy Pelosi what to do, and that she should, we'll see where that ends up leading.
Okay.
And as a transition, I guess I can go to Congressman Ben McAdam.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I'm sure you were going to go to next. So he's our Utah's only Democrat in Congress. He's a freshman, right? He's in a Republican district. And he's in a pretty tough spot that I think Gerke could talk to in a minute. But McAdams is pretty much saying, he's following Mitt Romney's lead here, and saying that he's concerned if the president, used his power to pressure a foreign leader to dig up dirt on arrival. That's troubling. He is not, however, supporting necessarily the impeachment inquiry as much as he said, we need to know what happened. But he is not one of the 17 to 18 Democrats now who say that the president should either be impeached or investigated for possible impeachment.
Okay. I do want to bring Robert Greeke in on that point, but first I want to just get a little bit more of this story out, Tommy, if we can. I mentioned this earlier that there has been some concern over what the acting director of national intelligence did with this whistleblower's complaint or what he didn't do with this complaint. Can you talk about that part of the story? Because that will kind of lead us into some of the other reactions, including from Utah Republican Representative Chris Stewart.
Chris Stewart.
Yeah. And
Patrick Stewart. That he'd be fun to cover.
Right. I had. Well. Anyway. But so. Yeah. Can you talk about the sort of lockdown of the document that is being alleged?
Yeah, we're learning a lot more every day. I'm sure that we'll learn more in a couple hours too as this develops. So just to try to walk the listeners through. So there's a whistleblower. We now understand from the New York Times is a CIA agent who detailed the White House. He gets wind of this call, but the transcript, the rough summary, was apparently put into essentially compartmentalized. It was top secret, but there's their higher classifications. They took it, and it was really restricted. Only so many people could see it. It's held on one single server that couldn't be accessed by other intelligence officials. And he thought that was very concerned, and Nancy Pelosi's called it a cover-up. So he writes this whistleblower complaint. It goes to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, and he finds it credible. He said the Inspector General said it was an urgent concern that appears credible. He investigated, talked to other people, and he forwarded the complaint and a letter to Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, who then sat on it. The law says very clearly that he shall send that report to Congress within 7 days if the Inspector General finds it credible, which he did. But the acting Director of National Intelligence instead went to the White House and went to the Office of Legal Counsel, the Justice Department, to say, oh, I don't know, is this protected by executive privilege? Which then started this whole concern by Democrats that they were trying to hide from the public what actually happened.
And that can bring us up to Representative Chris Stewart, who in various interviews has said, well, there's nothing to see there. Basically, this is okay. This is legal. Can you talk about Chris Stewart's response?
Yeah, sure. So Stewart has been, as we all have seen, a pretty staunch defender of the president. And in this case, he continues to be so. He was very much against the idea of the impeachment inquiry. He said that you shouldn't start out with a guilty finding and then move to a proceeding. He thinks that Pelosi betrayed her office by doing so. And he's pretty much said there's no there in this conversation. There was no quid pro quo, that there was no threat against Ukraine, that just asking Ukraine to look back into the 2016 election interference was not trying to help him, and it was actually trying to get to the bottom of what, quote, really happened. And we saw that again yesterday when Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, was before the House Intelligence Committee, and Stewart gave a very, very, as I called it, a full-throated defense of McGuire, calling the Democrats sitting next to him nuts because they were trying to malign him, even though the Democrats are pointing out that the law was very clear. McGuire was supposed to send this to Congress, and he did not.
And I want to turn back now to Robert Greeke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And there's a lot to unpack here. Maybe we'll go back to the reaction from Ben McAdams, our freshman Democrat in Washington. You wrote a column about that this week, how he is responding to all of this and the sort of political calculus behind it. Can you tell us your thoughts on that?
Well,
part of
I mean, Ben is in a very difficult situation, frankly, because so in his district, there's a 12% Republican lean, 12% more Republican voters than Democratic voters. So for him to win his district, as he did by the narrowest of margins in the last election, he's got to win over unaffiliated voters, those independents, and some moderate Republicans. And so he can't go out there and sort of toe the line on a lot of Democratic issues like like his Democratic constituents would like him to, and still expect to retain support from those more moderate Republican voters. And so he's in a spot politically that's difficult. His reaction has been, well, let's see where the facts lead, which is a reasonable position, I think. You don't vote to impeach the president without having the facts. But what I said in my column, and what I still think is true, is that the method for reaching the facts of whether or not there has been an impeachable offense is an impeachment inquiry, an investigation under the auspices of impeachment. And that's the constitutional mechanism for getting to the bottom of this, right? And so that's what's underway now. The fact of the matter is, what Ben McAdams thinks or doesn't think about impeachment doesn't really matter all that much. He's not a senior member. He's one of 234 Democrats in the House. He's not on the relevant committees necessarily. So from a practical standpoint, what he thinks doesn't matter in terms of where this is going. But it matters to his constituents, particularly his Democratic constituents, and we've seen in social media, in particular, a backlash, I think, from those more progressive, maybe we call them the Bernie wing of the party, who want to see him, you know, getting in line with his party.
We could dig a lot further into that, but I'm just looking at the clock here, and maybe I'll have you comment on how Stewart has been responding to this, Representative Chris Stewart.
Predictably. I mean, nobody expects Chris Stewart to exercise rational thought anymore. And so he's a rank partisan. And so he's, and it's kind of a little bit disturbing that he's a member of the Intelligence Committee and has more access to the information than most of us do, and is expected as a member of that committee to make sure that our intelligence community is not being used for political purposes and is not being abused by the president of the United States. And you know, for him to have been such a staunch defender, to be so dismissive, I guess, of what we've seen come out in the last few days, without really, you know, even from a neutral perspective, recognizing, as Mitt Romney did, that this raises some serious concerns about the way the president is using the intelligence community, his personal attorney, the Department of Justice, to dig up dirt. I mean, I think that's the words the president used to go after his political rival. It's disturbing.
Can I ask? Go ahead.
Whether or not there was a quid pro quo, and it looks like, as Tommy mentioned, with the $400 million in military defense hanging over the Ukrainian president's head, with Russia right next door to him, there's a little bit of a discomfort there, I think, for the Ukrainian president. And he narrowly won election. With all of that hanging over his head, even if there is no quid pro quo, I think the use of the intelligence apparatus as a political tool is something that, you know, Chris Stewart has accused the Obama administration of having done that. But this is black and white, you know, in the president's own words. You know, that's what's happening.
So with, you know, whether or not there's a kind of form of bribery happening, the fact that it's do me a favor, investigate my political rival is, in your mind, damning enough.
It's wrong in itself. And again, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, Chris Stewart should have some concern about that. And he doesn't seem to, and he doesn't, because his head's in the sand. You know, he doesn't want to see the facts before his face. And so, you know, he's doing the rounds on Fox and Friends and all the Fox News programs and spouting almost verbatim the Republican talking points. Wow, that was a slip up. The Republican talking points, and we know that because the Republicans actually sent them to all of the Democrats, and then tried to call them back. But you know, the talking points are exactly what he's being told by the White House to say.
Excuse me, Tommy, there in Washington, Thomas Burr, Washington bureau chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. Are things changing rapidly here? Meaning, how much support is there for impeachment, both in the House and then, you know, is the Senate? We expect, or we have been imagining, is not going to go that route. But can you talk about how quickly the sort of landscape around this conversation is changing?
Yeah, there's so many words you could use to describe this phrase. Is like, you know, the dam broke this week. There's no question about it. You know, before there was a core of Democrats who were already talking about we should impeach the president over what happened with Russia after the Mueller investigation. But when all this stuff came out, especially when Moore leaked about this conversation with Ukraine, Democrats just came out of the woodwork to support either full-out impeachment or at least start an impeachment inquiry, which forced Nancy Pelosi to do so. In the Senate, I think you're still seeing, kind of lockstep. Each party is doing what we expect them to do, with, of course, Mitt Romney being the kind of the lone guy out there saying, I'm really deeply troubled. I would like to say nationally, though, we're also seeing a change because previously, all these polls have showed by impeachment, like 80-90% of Democrats, say it should happen. 80-90% of Republicans say that's, crazy. But it's starting to change a little bit. It's still a majority of Americans don't support an impeachment, but it's starting to grow that direction. And we'll see where that goes as more of this information comes out.
Yeah, I mean, the polling that Tommy's referring to, there's been one poll done that I've seen so far, and it does show that some of Trump's Republican base is softening a little bit more than we've seen in the past. And I think the thing that, and I'm not the first person to say this, but one of the things that's unique about this, as opposed to the Russia investigation, is that this is pretty black and white. It's pretty clear cut. Did he do this, and is it wrong? And the facts are a lot less in dispute in this matter. It's just the perceptions, and those perceptions are often driven by partisanship, I think. And then politically, I think, this could run its course quickly, I think. I've read that Pelosi is talking about possibly having articles of impeachment drafted by the end of the year. I think that's pretty aggressive. But then we get into 2020 and it's an election year. And I think for Republicans, this puts Republicans in a tough spot electorally because you've got a president who has this hanging over his head going into 2020. And then you've got Republican members of the House in swing districts who are going to be put on the spot about whether they think this is proper or not. And possibly some Senate seats, up at Susan Collins, for example, and some of the more moderate senators in sort of battleground states, I think this becomes a problem for them politically.
Hmm. And Tommy, that's the process. I mean, waiting for the inquiry to happen. I mean, what are the next steps here in terms of what we should be expecting to see next in the House?
Yeah, so we're not sure how long the investigation is going to go, but as Gerke pointed out, they don't want to wait around too long. So there's six different committees now that are going to start doing their investigation. They're all going to forward their information to the House Judiciary Committee, which then is charged with writing up in the impeachment, the articles, the charges, essentially. And then once that, if the Judiciary Committee, as we expect, votes them out, that goes to the full House, and then the House has to vote to impeach the president. And then if that happens, it goes to the Senate, which holds a trial. Essentially, the Chief Justice of the United States presides over a trial with the senators as essentially the jury. And it takes 2/3 of them to actually remove the president from office. Of course, we all remember the last time this happened was Bill Clinton, who the House actually did impeach, but the Senate declined to remove her from office.
And I think the next thing that we kind of want to watch for is Representative Schiff, who heads the House Intelligence Committee, said the other day that the whistleblower wants to testify. And I think that could be sort of the next big milestone in this whole thing.
Do you think, Robert Gerke, just before we head to a break, that, the sort of ideal here is that we have this careful airing of the facts, but something makes me think that we're probably in for a lot of mudslinging instead? I mean, is this going to be a political circus in the end?
I mean, outside of probably the Nixon impeachment, this is oftentimes a political process,
right.
The impeachment process. When you had Andrew Johnson impeached, when we had Bill Clinton impeached, and now this time, politics often drive this. And I think Democrats aren't fooling themselves into thinking that the Republicans are, that they're going to put together articles of impeachment, send them to the Senate, and the Republicans in the Senate are going to approve them. Mitch McConnell has made pretty clear that he doesn't see anything wrong here, and he still has a lot of SWAT with the Republican Senate. So, is anything going to come of this? Probably not in the long run. But I mean, being impeached as a president is also, as I said, it's sort of a heavy political burden to bear, and it's a historical black mark.
We've had Brian Maffley, Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands reporter, sitting here in studio quietly. I'm just wondering, Brian, if you want to comment on any of this before we head to a break.
I don't even have any opinions on the matter, Roger.
I love it. And okay, that's great. We'll come back to you in a minute. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief, any final words before we head to our 2-minute break here?
No, I think the next thing I'd like to see is Rudy Giuliani testifying. I think that would be a very fascinating day.
Yeah. All right. That's Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief, and bringing us up to speed on what's happening in Washington. We're going to take a quick break and then turn to some big changes to the planned Lake Powell pipeline when we come back. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley, news columnist Robert Gerke, and Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join the conversation by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting or sending a tweet with your comments to at KCPW. Brian Maffley, the Lake Powell Pipeline is a big water infrastructure project to move Colorado River water from Lake Powell to the St. George area. This week, some pretty major changes to what the pipeline would look like under a new plan from the state. What are these big changes, Brian?
Well, for a long time, the state of Utah had kind of sold this project as a renewable energy project because it was going to generate some hydroelectricity when the water was going to go on the downhill side of the pipeline into Washington County, namely mostly at the Hurricane Cliffs. So they announced this week that it was necessary to drop these major parts of it that would generate hydropower, namely these reservoirs that would be at the bottom and the top of the Hurricane Cliffs. Hurricane Cliffs, I got to say it right.
Yeah.
I'm from Utah, after all. And these reservoirs would be used to store water temporarily so that it can be released during peak electrical demand times. That was, you know, and this was a way to kind of green up the project, but it was going to increase its footprint and cause some permitting headaches. So they decided to drop them, and it will save about $100 million off of construction.
The state also withdrew its application for approval of the Lake Powell pipeline from a federal agency after spending millions of dollars on that application. Can you talk about that part of the story? This is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Yes, known as FERC. So there's an important backstory there. So this is a 140-mile pipeline that crosses land under the jurisdiction of several federal agencies, mostly BLM, but also the Park Service and the Bureau of Reclamation. And it's never really clear who should the permitting agency be. So they went to the state, went to FERC, hoping that they would be the one and only permitting agency. And but you know, FERC handles energy projects, not water infrastructure. And they rejected that request last year to be the sole permitting agency. And that kind of opened up a lot of uncertainty for the project's regulatory pathway. So, what happened this week is just kind of a predictable outcome that the state officials responsible for this project, finally kind of conceded that, no, this is a water project, not an energy project. We're going to focus it in. And there still will be hydro components to it, but they're called conduit generation. It's turbines within the pipeline.
They're
exempt from FERC permitting, so they'll still have minor pieces of the hydro part. But long story short is the footprint of the project's going to be shrunken somewhat.
Okay, and the fact that they've withdrawn it from FERC is reflective of the fact that they don't have the big energy components as part of the water pipeline anymore.
Exactly.
So how will the state get federal approval of this project if not from that one agency?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer's not entirely certain. So thousands of pages of documents have been submitted to FERC. Millions spent. I think more than $30 million has been spent by the state on designing and planning and in various studies. And a lot of that work, the Division of Water Resources says, well, you know, it'll be useful regardless of which agency is handling the permits. And so it will be overseen by the Department of Interior. Mm-hmm. Now, and Reclamation, BLM, and Park Service are all interior agencies. So which of those will be the kind of the main player is up to Interior to decide. And so there'll be a very lengthy environmental analysis conducted. We're still years away.
How will this project be paid for? I mean, how is it supposed to be paid for?
It's supposed to pay for itself. The taxpayers of Utah are covering the costs, the upfront costs, and they are to be paid back by Washington County Water District through increased water rates for the folks in St. George and Kanab in that area, property taxes, and impact fees on new development.
Does all of that pencil out? Does it look feasible?
I think it totally depends on who you ask.
Okay.
Yeah. If the critics of the project, like Living Rivers or Utah Rivers Council, no, they say it's not going to pencil out, and they've done their own economic analyses. However, the legislative auditor has weighed in on this and concluded that the financial structure that the state has come up with will ultimately work out and pay for this project. But that all depends on will the cost of the project be within what the state says, which is $1.1 to $1.8 billion. What if there's huge cost overruns? What the critics of the project say is, look, you're going to raise water rates 300-400% over time to pay for this project. You increase the price of something, the demand's going to go down. If the demand goes down, will conceivably the need for the pipeline might evaporate.
Can you talk about the need? I mean, what is the problem this pipeline is supposed to be solving?
The problem is Washington County is a fast-growing part of Utah in the southwest corner of the state. It's extremely arid, and they have very high water needs to keep their lovely landscape going. So they have a fairly high per capita water use at the same time that thousands of people are, moving to that beautiful area. There's lots of wintertime golf, national parks, Snow Canyon State Park. It is truly one of the most beautiful places, desert places in our country. And it's relatively affordable. To sustain that growth, the state says they're going to need more water than they've currently have access to.
The opponents, like you mentioned, Utah Rivers Council, have said that the conversion of agricultural water as you develop more residential areas will be probably enough to cover the growth that is predicted. Is that?
Yeah, that's what Utah Rivers Council says. The others involved in this are groups called Conserve Southwest Utah and the Western Resource Advocates, who, they've done studies to kind of back this claim up that by converting water from agricultural uses and getting St. George's per capita water use in line with what's going on in Tucson or Las Vegas, problem solved. Who's right? I don't know. I just,
report.
I just try to get both sides in my story. So,
how are the opponents, especially those environmental, activists, or those from the environmental community, how are they reacting to the changes that were announced by the Utah Division of Water Resources about getting rid of those hydropower components, et cetera?
Yeah, there's a lot of, this proves what we've been saying all along, that this project doesn't really have a purpose. There's a lot of there's a lot of speculative kind of things going on here. It's not justified. It's kind of predictable.
Just given their complaints and the big divide over, like you said, you don't know who's right, but is there any chance that, these groups say that the project is unnecessary? Is there a chance that the state might give up on this project at some point? I mean, they've put a lot of money into it.
Yeah.
The legislature has sort of approved it but they have said they've endorsed it.
Yeah. The pipeline's being built pursuant to a law that was passed about 12, 13 years ago. So a lot has changed since then. We've been through 13 years of drought, although last year was fairly wet. But we have a lot of pressure going on the water resources in the Colorado River, where this water is coming from. And, you know, Mother Nature might, you know, pull the rug out from under this project. And also, you know, interstate politics, where there will be, you know, the agreements that regulate how much each of the Colorado River Basin states gets might get renegotiated in the coming years, given the depletion of that resource. And so, you know, what if it's in some of these renegotiations between now and when the pipeline gets built, you know, Utah's share has to be cut back. And, you know, what if, you know, Lake Powell or Glen Canyon Dam is no longer a tenable dam because the water level's so low? You know, if that happens and there's no more Lake Powell, you can't have a Lake Powell pipeline.
Well, the depletion of the resource and a lot of people depending on this one river. I'm just going to do a little side plug for a KCPW program. In the Hive, we looked at the state of Lake Powell and the Colorado River in a recent episode. Check that out. You reported before that groups like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA expressed concerns about those reservoirs that have been planned and are now withdrawn. And those concerns had to do with the environmental impacts of building those reservoirs. Now that those reservoirs aren't part of this project, are those concerns from those federal agencies allayed? I mean, are they on board?
Well, probably not entirely. A 140-mile pipeline has the potential for a lot of other impacts, impacting water resources, habitat for endangered species, you know, any number of things. You know, by taking these reservoirs out, you've cleared up a lot of those concerns. So, you know, we will see. But, you know, the thing that really kind of puzzles me is that, gee, couldn't you have known about these issues a decade ago, you know, when you were first planning this? But
let's hear. We haven't brought in editorial voice columnist Robert Gerke. You get to, you know, make opinions and write opinions. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I mean, I think By removing the hydropower component of this, it probably makes the pipeline even less attractive in some ways. The benefits of it are diminished, I think, by removing the hydropower component. It's been interesting to watch Governor Herbert on this because he still has traditionally been a little bit skeptical, I think, of the pipeline. Now, that's not to say the state's not supporting it and proceeding with it. But he has raised concerns about, you know, have we done what we can do in terms of conservation? And as Brian mentioned, St. George is wildly out of line in terms of its water use per capita when you compare it to places like Tucson and Las Vegas. And so, you know, can we bring that down? There's talk at the legislature ongoing right now about changing the way we price water to, you know, to basically make users pay for it. And if you use more, you pay more, and that encourages conservation. It's something that has been talked about for years, should have been done years ago, and we haven't been able to pull that off yet. The governor is also concerned about whether it actually pencils out. And so the state will likely be involved in some capacity going forward. We may end up, you know, covering the bond, I guess, or issuing the bonds that pay for it. But, you know, the question is it necessary? Is it affordable? And I think those questions still remain to be, you know, remain valid. And the FERC withdrawal doesn't necessarily change that, except for maybe making the cost benefit analysis weigh a little bit more heavily toward the cost and less toward the benefit. So,
Brian Maffley, just before we head to another break on the show, any, you know, additional things we need to know about what's happening with the Lake Powell pipeline project from your story before we move on?
Oh, no, I think, you know, that was the key development that we touched on. Yeah.
Okay. Brian Maffley is public lands reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're going to take a quick break here on the show and then return with a story about coal mining in the state of Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. This is the weekly Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Thomas Burr, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can tweet us at KCPW. That's our handle. Brian, I want to move on to some other news that you covered from this past week and the revival of a Utah coal mine. This is the Trail Mountain coal mine in eastern Utah, and its owners say that they will ramp up production there in the near future. We've heard a lot about the death of coal, that it's not economical anymore. Why this project now, Brian Maffley?
Yeah, the company involved is they're now known as Wolverine Fuels. Resource Partners.
Would you say that again? I turned off your microphone. Formerly what?
Formerly Bowie Resource Partners. They're a Kentucky-based coal mining outfit that looked west in 2013 and bought up a lot of big coal assets in Utah, including the three most productive mines, namely SUFCO, Dugout, and Skyline. Also have acquired a lot of big leases associated with those mines. And another lease they acquired from Pacific Core is called Fossil Rock. About 3,000 acres, mostly state land as opposed to federal. And according to the executives of this company, it's got 58 million tons of really great coal. And Asian markets would love to burn this coal because it's such better stuff than they can get from Australia.
And that's what they've got their eyes on, is exporting to Asian markets. What's the sort of route that coal would go from this eastern Utah mine to an export terminal somewhere to send it overseas?
Well, they're saying that this coal that they would get out of Fossil Rock, which is would be accessed through the old Trail Mountain mine near Castledale, mm-hmm. or actually Orangeville in Emery County, that coal would be burned in the nearby power plants, Hunter and Huntington. Big power plants. Wolverine has some contracts with Pacific Core for those plants. However, for this to work out for them, to maintain their production levels, they're producing about 9-10 million tons of coal a year. They need to get coal overseas, whether it's from this mine or SUFCO or whatever. And this is the company that was kind of a hidden mover and shaker behind the project in Oakland to develop an export terminal there. It got super controversial and tied up in the courts. Wolverine is now moving coal out of smaller ports in Stockton and Richmond, about 3 million tons a year. So, you know, Utah coal is sailing through the Golden Gate to Japan, but they've made it really clear that they want to increase the amount of coal they're shipping.
The fact that burning coal contributes to climate change, I suppose that's not necessarily much of a concern for state regulators or they're the ones who are leasing the land to this company, correct, for their mine?
So these leases were sold by Sitla at least 10 years ago. To a company that's, I don't even think it's involved in Utah coal anymore. And then Pacific Core acquired those leases somehow to resolve a lawsuit with that company. So when Bowie Resource Partners came to Utah, they were doing something that no other coal company in the West was doing, expanding their ownership of very costly assets. While other companies were getting rid of their leases, they were buying them. And it wasn't just leases. It was load-out infrastructure. It was processing plants. And then they've also bought two major BLM, federal leases. One's associated with Skyline Mine, the other one with SUFCO. Mm. I mean, this is a company that's doubling down on Utah coal. And they're saying that Asian markets would prefer Utah coal as opposed to Asian coal because the content of energy is really high, over 11,000 British thermal units, and the sulfur content is very low, half a percent more or less. And the less sulfur you have, the less you know, toxic the emissions are.
Okay. I'm sorry that we're going to have to cut this conversation short, but Robert Gerke, just a comment on the revival of a Utah coal mine and coal in general?
I mean, it seems like it's probably not a great bet to bet on coal right now. We've seen in Utah alone, you know, the production, the amount, the percentage of electricity or percentage of energy we get from coal is dropping precipitously. I think it's down 15% in the last 8 years. And it reflects a global trend. Now, there are places, as Brian mentioned, the Asian market that they think they can sell this coal into. But, you know, we're seeing PacifiCorp, for example, which owns Rocky Mountain Power, is forecasting closing plants in Wyoming. They've got plans to close their plants here in Utah. Coal has a limited lifespan, and so if they think that they can get the money out of this and create a market overseas that will sustain it, I guess they can give that a shot. But in the long term, it seems like it's it's on life support.
We are going to have to leave it there and turn to our underplayed stories of the week, because that's the time that we've hit here in the show. And we're going to start with Thomas Burr, who I know has to leave here in just a moment. So, Thomas Burr, do you want to start with your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Sure. I think it's this is one of those things that always happens. So everyone's been very focused on the whistleblower, on the president's call with Ukraine, and so that's dominating all the news. Meanwhile, the White House unveils a plan to roll back how many refugees can come to the United States. It was it's been set at 30,000. Now they're dropping that to 18,000. So it's just one of those things where we all kind of get distracted by this, you know, this crazy stuff that's happening out of the White House. Meanwhile, they're actually still pushing through policies that will make a dramatic difference.
Okay. Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief. And with that, we will let you go. Thanks for joining us this hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Maffley, your pick for underplayed story.
This is an easy one. Our colleague Zach Podmore had a story this week about what amounts to a new city being developed on state land south of Moab in Spanish Valley, outside the jurisdictional reach of Grand County, I might add, in San Juan County. And it could, you know, basically double the population of the Moab area if it comes to pass. And Robert weighed in on his column also on this last week, this week.
Robert, do you want to make a quick comment on this?
Just real quick. I mean, I think Moab, we can all agree, has some serious problems right now. You can't drive through town. It's got, you know, it's overgrown. There's no affordable housing. And I think by taking the long-term planned view that they're talking about with the Sitla project, I think it could avoid a lot of those problems and alleviate a lot of the pressures on Moab area.
Okay. I hadn't read your column. That's not exactly what I was expecting to hear from you, but it's an interesting take. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
Well, we've talked about this on the program before, but yesterday the state licensing board that regulates conversion therapy or psychological practices met to discuss this rule they're proposing to ban conversion therapy. As you remember, there was a bill last session. It sort of got hijacked and killed. And so the governor directed this licensing board to develop rules that would ban it administratively. That seems to be progressing. There was a lot of back and forth and public input on it, you know, the typical opponents, but it seems we're moving in that direction. I also just real quickly wanted to plug, we're getting into sort of the home stretch of the Salt Lake City mayoral campaign, and you should check out sltrib.com to check out some of Taylor Stevens' excellent reporting on the important issues that they're going to be addressing.
Indeed, that was my pick for underplayed story of the week.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. There's a side-by-side comparison of candidates responding issue by issue by Taylor Stevens in the Salt Lake Tribune. Check that out. Again, the web address, sltrib.com. Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke, both with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for being here on Behind the Headlines.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool.
Good
thank
weekend.
You.
Yeah. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at our website, kcpw.org. Thanks for help from Jesse Ellis, our operations and programming director, and from producer Tim Pierce here at KCPW this hour. That's it for Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.